This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a review lecture about odontoid fractures by Dr. Derek Moore, who is of course the founder of OrthoBullets and a practicing orthopedic spine surgeon at Santa Barbara Orthopedic Associates.
Okay, now we're going to talk about odontoid fractures in the adult and pediatric populations. Odontoid fracture is a fracture of the dens of the axis, otherwise known as C2. In terms of the epidemiology, this is a common fracture pattern. It is the most common fracture of the axis and accounts for about 10 to 15% of all cervical fractures. In terms of the demographics, you see this fracture pattern in two different patient populations. First, you see it in elderly patients, where it is usually the result of a low energy accident, such as a fall with a hit on the head. It is important to note that in the elderly population, this fracture pattern is associated with a high mortality rate due to complications related to treatment. The other patient population we see this in is young patients. In young patients, it's usually the result of high energy trauma. It might be a motor vehicle accident or a fall from height. In terms of the pathophysiology, displacement might be either anterior due to hyperflexion or posterior due to hyperextension. When you have anterior displacement, it's often associated with a injury to the transverse ligament, which does lead to atlanto-axial instability. Posterior displacement is caused by direct impact from the anterior arch, usually during a hyperextension injury. In terms of the biomechanics, it should be noted that a fracture through the base of the odontoid can lead to a significantly unstable fracture pattern, and therefore it's important to evaluate these patients properly. In terms of associated conditions, you need to be aware of os odontium. Os odontium may look like a type 2 fracture, especially on the x-rays. However, if you get a CT scan, what really separates it is that you have the sclerotic margins, more round shape, which does not resemble an acute fracture. So this would be consistent with an os odontium. It used to be thought that these were due to an old failure of fusion, but new evidence now supports that it might actually be the residue of an old traumatic process. Regardless, this is not treated operatively. This process has been there for a while, and these people can be treated with observation alone. Okay, let's go over some of the anatomy of the axis. In terms of the osteology, the axis is formed of primarily the body and the dens. In terms of the embryology, it derives from five ossification systems. The first ossification system is the odontoid, then you have the body, and then you have the neural arches. You should be aware that you do have the basilar synchondrosis. The formation of or the fusion of the neural arches with the odontoid usually occurs around 6 years of age, so be aware of that when you see x-rays and you see something that looks like an odontoid fracture in a young child. You also want to be aware that there is a secondary ossification center. This usually forms around age 3 in children and it fuses around age 12 in children. In terms of the kinematics of the axis, the C12, there's actually two articulations that the axis is involved with. The first is the C12 or the atlanto-axial articulation. This is a diarthrodial joint. Again, the C2 body or the axis is involved in both your atlanto-axial articulation and your subaxial motion at the C2-3 level. The atlanto-axial joint, it's primarily responsible for rotation. In the cervical spine, there's about 100 degrees of rotations, and about 50% of this comes from the atlanto-axial joint. The axis also has your C2-3 articulation. This is a part of the subaxial spine. Extends from C3 all the way down to C7. The subaxial spine is involved in all planes of motion, including flexion extension, where it makes up about 50 degrees and about 50 degrees of rotation. But you can see what's unique about the subaxial spine is lateral bent. Subaxial spine makes up for about 60% of a total of 68% of lateral bend seen in the cervical spine, so it is the primary source of lateral bend. So there's some very important ligamentous stabilizers in this area. You need to be familiar with the transverse ligament, apical ligament, and alar ligaments. The apical ligament is a single midline structure that goes from the tip of the dens up to the occiput. It is a very weak structure. In contrast, you have the two alar ligaments that go from the side of the dens and goes out to the occiput. This is an important stabilizer of the occipital cervical joint. The last ligament that you need to be aware of is the transverse ligament. And the transverse ligament extends from the lateral mass of C1 and it wraps around the dens of C2 and really hugs that dens and pulls it anterior to the anterior arch of C1. So this is the transverse ligament and it is the primary stabilizer of that lantoaxial joint. In terms of the blood supply, the odontoid receives blood supply from two regions. From the inferior region, it receives a blood supply from the vertebral artery, and that is the primary blood supply for the base or the body of the C2. In contrast, the dens receives a blood supply from a descending supply from branches of the internal carotid artery. And because you have this blood supply coming from these two sources, the middle area here is a watershed area. And this is important because this is where a type 2 odontoid fracture occurs and you have increased pseudoarthrosis rates in this region. You need to be familiar with the classification system because it does dictate treatment. It is the Anderson and DeLonzo classification system. So there's three types, type 1, type 2, and type 3. So type 1 fractures are an oblique avulsion fracture of the tip of the dens. This is actually an avulsion fracture of the alar ligament. So again, the alar ligament is an important stabilizer to the occiput. It comes from the occiput down to the side of the dens, and you can have this avulsion injury. The vast majority of these are stable injuries. In books, this can be associated with instability, so they say that if you do see a type 1 fracture, and again, they're very rare, you do want to get flexion extension x-rays to make sure there's no instability, and that instability would be at the occipital cervical junction. Much more common is your type 2 fracture. Again, this occurs at the waist of the odontoid. Again, as we just discussed, this is your watershed area because the vertebral artery supplies the body and the internal carotid has branches that goes to the dens, leaving a relatively avascular zone. And this is important because you do have a significant pseudoarthrosis rate with this type of fracture pattern. In terms of stability, type 2 fracture is just below the transverse ligament, and that means that you really lose your stability of C2 relative to C1 if you have a fracture pattern here. So this can lead to a significantly unstable injury. Again, because this is below the transverse ligament, injury here would lead to instability of that atlantoaxial joint, which is different than the instability seen of the occipital cervical joint with a type 1 up here. Type 2 fractures are often difficult to see in your lateral x-rays. The first thing you want to look for is the anterior arch of C1, and this fracture pattern would be just below it. It is much easier to see on a CT scan. Again, first you want to identify your anterior arch of C1. The last type is a type 3, so this is a fracture pattern that extends down into the body of C2. And as we discussed, this is a well vascularized area with a good blood supply coming from a branch of the vertebral artery. Other important thing to note about this fracture pattern is that it is an interarticular and that it usually involves a portion of the C1-2 facet. Okay, so let's talk about the presentation of these fracture patterns. These patients usually present with neck pain. The pain is worse with motion. They might have dysphagia if there's a large retropharyngeal hematoma, but again, that's rare. On physical exam, you're going to see pain. They're usually going to be in a cervical collar by the time you see them. They are going to have significant pain with any types of minor rotation of the cervical spine. You do want to check for myelopathy, although it is very rare in these patients. The reason it's rare is because at this level of the cervical spine, you have a lot, the cross-sectional area of the spinal canal at this level is quite large, and therefore there's a lot of extra room for the spinal cord at this level. So even if you have some minor displacement of the dens, it's very rare that this leads to a significant amount of compression, and it's very rare that these patients have myelopathic symptoms. All right, now we'll talk about imaging studies. So required views are your standard trauma series, AP, lateral, and open mouth odontoid views of the cervical spine. If you're suspicious of any type of instability, either with a type 2 fracture or a type 1, again, with a type 1, you're concerned about occipital cervical instability, or type 2, you're concerned about atlantoaxial instability. If you are concerned, you want to obtain flexion extension x-rays. If you see an ADI of 10, then you have instability at the atlantoaxial joint. You also want to look for the degree of space available for the cord. If you have less than 13 millimeters, this is associated with instability. A CT scan is really the study of choice to delineate the fracture pattern in these patients. Sometimes you do want to obtain a CT angiogram. You only need a CT angiogram when you're considering surgical treatment, and the reason for this is you want to identify an anomalous vertebral artery. When do you get an MRI? Usually a CT scan is enough. If you obtain a CT scan, there's no significant displacement and the patient doesn't have any neurologic symptoms, you don't need a MRI. MRIs are indicated when you do see significant displacement and you're concerned about some type of compression on the spinal cord, or if the patient has symptoms of myelopathy or cord compression. All right, let's talk about treatment. It's actually very simple. You just want to break it down into non-operative treatment and operative treatment. Operative treatment, there's two techniques, either a posterior C1-2 fusion or anterior screw osteosynthesis. There isn't good data supporting one or the other, so they're not going to make you choose between those treatment options. What they're really going to make you choose between is non-operative versus operative treatment, at least on the U.S. boards. So to choose between those two, what you want to do is you want to break it down into these five different categories. You have osteodontium, type 1 fractures, type 2 in the young, type 2 in the elderly, and type 3. And if you break it down into these five categories, it's pretty easy to determine how to treat these. So on a high level, the only ones that are treated surgically are type 2 fractures. So if you have an osteodontium, the treatment is non-operative with just observation. If you have a type 1 or a type 3, again, these are simple. You put these in a cervical orthosis. There's no data supporting a halo in these patients, so proceed with a cervical orthosis. Now again, it's the type 2 fractures that are more complicated and sometimes require surgery. The reason it's more complicated is, as we discussed, these fractures occur through the waist, which is a poorly vascularized area, so you do have a high rate of non-union, which is not ideal considering that a non-union can lead to instability. So to determine whether these patients require surgery or not, first break them down into the young and the elderly. In young patients, if they have no risk factors for a non-union, you treat them with a halo. So you need to know what your risk factors for non-union are, and we'll talk about this again, but they are significant displacement, significant angulation, comminution, age greater than 50 years of age, or delays in treatment. So a young patient does not have any of those risk factors, you can treat them in a halo. If they do have one of those risk factors, then you want to treat them with surgery, either anterior odontoid screw osteosynthesis or posterior C1-2 fusion. The other thing that makes type 2 tricky is that you cannot put elderly patients in a halo. My grandfather had an odontoid fracture. He was placed in a halo and he died of pneumonia because of it. You do not want to put elderly patients in a halo. This is tested over and over again. Do not forget that. So if you have an elderly patient and they're surgical candidates, then you want to go ahead with surgical stabilization. Usually you do a posterior C1-2 fusion in this patient. If they are not surgical candidates, then you just want to go ahead and put them in a cervical orthosis. Chances are they're not going to go on to a fusion, but it's going to give them enough stability to live the remainder of their life. So going through this again, as we discussed, observation alone is indicated in osteodontoidium. Hard cervical orthosis is indicated in, as we mentioned, either type 1 fractures you treat in a cervical orthosis, type 3 fractures you always treat in a cervical orthosis, and for type 2, elderly patients who are not good surgical candidates, you're going to just treat in a cervical orthosis. So halo vest immobilization, these patients, there's only one real indication for a halo vest. Truth is, in practice, people really don't use halos anymore, but on this test, it is a treatment option. So halo vest immobilization is going to be used in your type 2 fracture in young patients with no risk factors for non-union. Just remember, you do not put elderly patients in halo vest. So operative treatment, as I said, the indications for operative treatment, whether you do a posterior C1-2 fusion or anterior screw osteosynthesis, are really the same. You do this in type 2 fractures with risk factors for non-union, or type 2 fractures in elderly patients who are surgical candidates, and the other indication for it is in type 2, 3 non-unions. Anterior screw osteosynthesis, again, indications for surgery are the same. This is a procedure you're going to do either in type 2 fractures in the young who have risk factors for non-union, or in type 2 fractures in the elderly who are candidates for surgery. How do you choose between either a C1-2 posterior fusion or an anterior screw osteosynthesis? There's data basically supporting both of these, and there's really no data showing one is better than the other. There are certain patients that are ideal for anterior screw osteosynthesis. This is when the dens is well aligned with minimal displacement. The fracture pattern should be perpendicular to the trajectory of the screw, and their body habitus has to be appropriate. Patients who have a large barrel chest or are obese, it's difficult to drop your hand to get the trajectory to place the screw. In some patients, you can have posterior displacement of the dens to a point that it's leading to significant compression on the spinal cord. In these patients, you need to remove the odontoid. That is not something you can do posteriorly because you can't get around the spinal cord to get there. So this has to be done through a transoral approach, usually done by the neurosurgeons. All right, let's talk a little bit about the surgical techniques. So let's talk about C1, C2 posterior fusion techniques. So this is a very common operation done at the occipital cervical region. Your approach is done through a posterior midline cervical approach, and there's really three stabilization techniques. There's the old techniques that used to be used, which involved sublaminar wiring techniques. This involved the techniques of Galilei and Brooks. These techniques required postoperative halo immobilization, which is really not ideal. So the truth is that these sublaminar wiring techniques are not used very often. They are used in, you know, third world countries where they don't have access to pedicle screws and rod constructs. So what is commonly used in the United States is one of two constructs. First is a posterior C1 transarticular screw construct, and the second is a posterior C1 lateral mass and a C2 pedicle screw construct. It's very important that you know your anatomy of the vertebral artery, and this is frequently tested because whenever you're doing any work in the posterior cervical spine around C1, C2, the vertebral artery is one of your primary concerns. Again, just review of your anatomy. C7 does have a transverse foramen, but the vertebral artery does not go into it. It enters the transverse foramen at C6. It comes up through the transverse foramen of C6, C5, C4, C3, and you can see it entering through the transverse foramen of C2, and then it travels up to the transverse foramen of C1. There it makes a 90-degree turn, goes medially just on the superior surface of the posterior arch of C1, and then it ascends where it meets the other vertebral artery between the basilar artery, where it runs up the anterior surface of the brainstem and supplies, you know, essential functions to the brainstem and other parts of the brain. So that means when you're placing these screws, you need to be working in a safe zone that is basically within 1.2 centimeters from midline, because you don't want to go too lateral, because that is where the vertebral artery is. And then you want to stay inferior to the posterior arch of C1. So this is really your safe zone. To place your lateral mass screw, you want to drop just below your posterior arch of C1. On your C1, C2, C1 lateral mass screw, C2 pedicle screws construct, your C2 pedicle screws are actually quite easy. This screw is medial to the transverse foramen, which is the location of your vertebral artery. So the alternative is your C1-2 transarticular screw construct. You know, the concept behind this is that this is your C1-2 articular surface, and if you can drive a screw across that facet, then you can obtain a fusion there, and you really don't need any other points of fixation in C1. So it's very important that you understand that where the anatomy is of the vertebral artery in a normal patient, and what's even more important is to recognize that a large portion of patients have anomalous variants of the vertebral artery. This was directly tested on the 2012 OIT. So an anomalous variant of the vertebral artery can either be extraosseous, where it might not go through the transverse foramen at all, might be sitting more lateral, or more concerning is when you have an intraosseous variant, meaning that the vertebral artery might actually be passing through the bone, which is the path for your transarticular screw. So it's very important to note that if you're thinking about doing any type of posterior work in the cervical spine, whether it's a C1 lateral mass, C2 pedicle screw construct, or a C1, C2 transarticular screw construct, you have to obtain some type of CT angiogram so you have a firm understanding of where the vertebral artery is and if there's any anomalous variance. As I said, this was directly tested on the 2012 OIT, where they asked what is a contraindication for a C1-2 transarticular screw, and the absolute contraindication was anomalous variant of the vertebral artery. So let's talk a little bit about anterior screw osteosynthesis. So this is done through an anterior approach. You know, the advantage of this is that the anterior approach is much easier than the posterior approach. On the posterior approach, the patient's prone, where in the anterior approach, the patient is supine. You basically do the same approach that you do for an ACDF, which is a fairly easy approach with minimal blood loss. What you do is you identify the C2, C3 disc space, and then you drive a screw straight up through the odontoid across the fracture pattern. So again, here you want to be aware of where your vertebral artery is. It's lateral at this point and you're working midline. However, the vertebral artery, as it goes above C1, it does move midline and it becomes the basilar artery, which is a midline structure. This is very important to note because many people advocate for a cortical screw purchase up here. So if you are obtaining cortical purchase here, make sure you do not pass point. The basilar artery is a midline structure. If you pass point, you will hit the basilar artery, and this can lead to death. That is, the basilar artery is critical for providing blood supply to the entire brain as well as the brainstem. The last technique is a transoral odontoectomy. Again, this is when you have significant posterior displacement of the dens leading to spinal cord compression. You can't remove the dens from posteriorly because the spinal cord's in the way, so you're going to use a transoral approach. This is usually combined with a posterior stabilization procedure. And finally, as I said, treatment is really dictated based on the presence of risk factors for non-union. Those risk factors are displacement of greater than 5 millimeters, fracture comminution, angulation of greater than 10 degrees, age greater than 50 years of age, or delays in treatment.
That's all for this review lecture about odontoid fractures. Hopefully that was helpful. We'll have a link to the video version of this lecture in the show notes for anyone who is interested. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.